Firstly, I was wondering, can you hear me if I don't hold the mic?
Yeah.
Okay. And also, my apologies for the camera, because I like to move about a bit. So, because I just want to try and instill, right at the very beginning, a feeling of optimism. Because these are unbelievably, potentially important and optimistic times. Just looking around the audience, I can see some of you are just starting out in a career of being really active. Some of us have been doing it, colouring the hair for a rather large number of decades. Either way, there will be, and there never has been, I think, in our lives, a better time to be campaigning on issues. Thank you to the Sheffield campaign against climate change for inviting me, not just for climate change, on a whole range of things. Because at the moment, these are the worst of times, and these are the best of times. They're the worst of times if you're about to lose your job, or have already lost your job, if you're insecure about your job, if you have lost your home, you're worried about losing your home, you're worried about your children, what they're going to do in the future, etc. It's very, very, very unsettling times. But, on the other hand, it is a time where there is going to be very, very dramatic change. Because the economy is in such deep and irredeemably deep difficulties. And it can't be sorted out by just business as usual. I fear there is in the mind of our esteemed leaders, Mr. Darling and Mr. Brown, the idea that this is a kind of rather irritating detour as we go through at the moment. That this is about maybe even nationalising banks, sort of not quite being able to say that, as Mr. Lord, sorry, Mandelson would say, being intensely relaxed about being incredibly wealthy. Not quite being able to say how wonderful the city is for bringing all this opulence and wealth and opportunity and blah, blah, blah for Britain. Because these things are getting a little difficult to say, but this is what has been their mindset for 30 years. Their mindset for 30 years is that the market is gold. Politicians' role is to get out of the way and then help the market. And then, if you do that, money will trickle down from there. Everyone will get wealthier and things will be fine. Now, unfortunately, that myth is now seen to be what it is. It's seen to be a completely busted foot. And the Green New Deal emerged because I used to have some conversations with the financial editor of The Guardian, Larry Elliott. If any of you feel economics is impossible to understand, even if you don't buy The Guardian newspaper, Google up Larry Elliott occasionally, because he does explain things very, very clearly. And he, like Vince Cable, the Liberal Democrat, was way, way ahead of the rest of the people in saying, hang on a second, there is a problem here. We have an economy built on ever-growing masses of debt. And this economy is not only bad for the environment, but is going to turn into a very severe economic downturn. Now, my background personally, I've been in the environment movement for a number of decades, working on a range of different issues, energy, nukes, food, etc. But over the last 20 years, it's become my obsession that the free market and open markets are actually the cause of much of the social and environmental problems that we've got. And I've written various books on youth protectionism, localisation, etc. about this. Now our time is coming. Because those who said this is a ludicrous idea, you can't button the market, the market's gone. Remember, it wasn't long ago, and it still is the case, I think, in the mentality of many of our political leaders, where it was absolutely unchallenged that the only purpose of the British economy, of the Latin American economy, of the Asian economy, American, was to bow down to the great God. Different one. The great God, international competitiveness. And this was the only God, and you will worship at the altar of that God. You will not tax people too highly, because that God will not be pleased. And bankers, those talented, brilliant creatures, will leave. You will not introduce too drastic an environmental policy, because the masters of the transnational company universe will leave. They will say, this is not a good place to do business. You are not, and here's the Trump card, you can't say anything against it, you are not internationally competitive. Oh! This is the brown crumble, this is the darling crumble, the old crumble, in the face of this unstoppable truth that the need to be internationally competitive is absolutely crucial. You must open markets, you must maximise trade. This is the only way to generate wealth. We must get out of the way of anything that stops us present. Now, people like that area, and I thought this was nonsense. But we can begin to see the potential for this model crumbling because of the debt crisis. And so I got together some people who've been thinking about this. Anne Pettiford, around the Jubilee 2000 campaign, wrote an excellent book called The Coming First World Debt Crisis. She realised after campaigning for debt in the third world, she knew nothing about debt in the first world. So she started to study it and realised, holy moly, this is really a depth chart under all of us. Other people, like Richard Murphy from the Tax Justice Network, Caroline Lucas, Supreme Member of the European Parliament, Jenny Junco, Scrum Back to the Earth, Jeremy Leggett, who I used to work with when I worked on Greenpeace and now runs a solar photovoltaic company. We all got together and decided we should write something about the coming crisis. Remember, this was 2 years ago. And so I started to look at what Roosevelt did. And so then I thought, well, it's actually quite simple. We need to update the New Deal. So I just thought we'll call it the Green New Deal. And in essence, what Roosevelt did was he was faced with the same problems that we're facing now. In America, the greedy had duped the gullible. People felt in the 20s that the laws of gravity, of economic gravity, were suspended. The stock market would always go up. People started to borrow money to buy shares. They halved the market went up and up and up. Everybody thought they could win. Does that sound familiar? Get rid of stock markets, put in bricks. Everybody started to think of their properties, as a cash cow. And of course, property values would never go down. You had the old blip, but basically it was like this. And so in the late 1920s, vast debts in order to pile into a phantasmagoric market of shares that then crashed in 1929. After that, there was a huge contraction in bank lending. Same thing. Here we have the same problem. It was all based on ever higher property prices. Bang! They start to go down. The whole cards begin to crumble. And so we're in a very similar situation. So I started to look at what Roosevelt did. He did three interesting things. The first thing he did, as most people realize, he started to ruthlessly control the banking and finance because they had been the cause of the problem. So he actually started to really legislate hard. He split sort of day-to-day banking from the more exotic investment banking, etc., etc., and started to return banking to what it ought to be, which is the provision of money in order for people to carry on their lives. He then, and this wasn't so well known,
I hadn't realised until I started researching.
He then realised that if you're going to get the economy going again, you have to have a lot of people buying things. And to buy things, you not only have to have a lot of people work, but you also have to, they have to get enough money to be able to buy things. And before the 1929 crash, there was a rapid, huge increase in the gap between rich and poor. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Same thing. Huge increase in the gap. And so he started a very, very, very strong tax system. Tax the rich, tax the companies, and also give trade unions some rights, which in America was a very real thing. And that resulted in something called, I haven't heard forever, the Great Compression, which meant actually the gap between rich and poor got less, and policies were geared to that. And that stayed right the way through Roosevelt, through the war, through Eisenhower, right up until Reagan, and the whole thing crashed. The reverse started to happen. So he controlled finance, he taxed the rich, and gave the people very basic rights. And then thirdly, the thing he's most well known for, he had a lot of public expenditure to actually improve the infrastructure of America. And that's say dams and roads and airports and right through to setting up a conservation corps, did fantastic work, and was the foundation of much of the environment movement that emerged after the war until now. So these three things, control finance, use taxation sensibly so you get some demand for whatever you're producing, and then putting the government money into rebuilding the infrastructure seemed the obvious thing to do. And so we got together and we wrote this report, the Green New Deal. And if you want to just Google up Green New Deal and NEF, New Economics Foundation. It reads rather quickly now. It came out last July. And it was supposed to be a trapped, educated, and politically active about the coming financial crisis. Well, now, of course, everybody knows about the coming financial crisis. It swept over the country shortly after we all broke all down. But the essence of the report is really the same as Roosevelt's. And that is the three-pronged thing, which is control finance in the banks, ensure that the tax system results in much more fairness, and then, and this is the major difference, use not just public money, but also private savings in order to invest not in airports and dams and more roads, but in green infrastructure, in green collar jobs, as they say in the States, to save energy, to change the agriculture system, to improve the transport system, use resources more rational, etc. So that was the proposals that we put out. And I think it's a small detour, first of all, very quickly, about why this is relevant not just for Britain and Europe, but also to the whole of the world. Because the essence behind it is the reality. We are talking about looking to the local to deal with the huge political crises that we've got. Because remember, the only thing any politician at any level is interested in over the next 10 years is, will it generate jobs? Will it generate business opportunities to stop the economy tanking? They are the only political concerns that are going to be. Now, the response to that is inevitably, it has been, to look more to the national economy. It's quite incredible, but tanker trade over the last year, the thing that's busy all over the world, has dropped nearly 90%. 90%. Money that used to spew all over the world is now jitteringly and scarily coming home to mummy nationally, and there's safe government guarantees for the money. So the open market, the globalisation model's already finished. Now, a lot of the ruling classes don't get that yet because they've been talking about it for a long time, but in reality it is. And I'd like just to say, for a second, why this is a good thing for developing countries.
We hear a lot
now about, just as it used to be, whoa, worship international commitment. It's now beware protections and oh. Can you imagine the impudence of the Americans when Barack Obama was spending hundreds of billions of pounds on infrastructure in America? What did he want? He wanted to use American steel in American infrastructure. How terrible! Europe went berserk. Brown and Mandelson rail at the threat posed by this appalling desire to actually use your own materials to sort out your own problems. And indeed, this is going to increase. And I'm going to say a word for a new green protectionism. Because I think protectionism, in the sense of protecting and rebuilding local economies globally, is the way forward. Not the old-fashioned protectionism after the big slump, where, you know, countries like America said, well, we'll protect our economy, but we'll still export to you. It's what I call one-sided protectionism. That's done. But if we look environmentally and socially, we need to not have stuff stealing the world. We need to ensure that as much production occurs locally as is possible. And that, I think, is a very good thing, particularly for developing countries, because there has been an appalling confidence shift, not based on evidence, based on you know, a desire to do good, but it's what I call the bog standard development theory for the third year. By Bob, I mean Bono, Oxfam, Gelbo. Now, all of these are good people who want to do good things, but they all have a daft model. And the model is as follows. The rich North will atone for its colonial sins by opening up its market to things from the South. The process will do some jobs for them, because we're very clever in the North, we'll move on to the high-tech industry, and we'll triumph in the world of high-tech. But then so for China, so for India. No, that's an embarrassing. You don't worry about that. No, high tech future for us. But we will open up markets to the exports of the third world. And then the third world will do really well. I mean, it's factual, it's ridiculous. Because what has actually happened is this policy, this bog standard development theory, pits every developing country against every other country. In virtually all the developing countries lose to China. In India. They can't compete. If you take, for example, African coffee producers, when Vietnam came in producing coffee, so out of nowhere, 2 or 3 years, they took over the whole market, 200,000 coffee producers. Malawi, women were trained in textile workers. The market opened up, Chinese exports came in, bang, they're out of job and into prostitution. I mean, it doesn't work. The idea that you all out-compete everybody else is a ghastly warfare model that is the heart of international trade. It's nonsense. So if every country starts to look more to itself, then, but doing it in an internationalist way, of course there has to be transfer of aid and technology and ideas from rich countries to poor countries. Sometimes they've got better ideas from poor countries back to rich countries. Ideas can flow, but what mustn't is goods and money on the scale that it has. So therefore, small detail, just to make the point that the kind of Green New Deal programme, which is in essence dealing with the huge in-your-face political nightmare of unemployment and corrupt economy, by chance also deals with the problems of the climate, because if we are producing things more locally and not using too much fossil fuel, then we're not burning as much. And it also deals with the energy crisis that we've got, and also deals with the ability of societies to take that control of their own economies. And that's what has been given away in the last 30 years. And it's now been forced to be taken back. Governments have been forced to govern again. They don't like it's great, they've got no choice. Luckily, in the White House, we've got someone who's rather used to the idea because it developed over time. He's used it from the Roosevelt's government. Okay, let's just turn it back to Britain a bit more. and the Greenwood Hill. When we launched House of the Lord to the Green Party conference last summer, last August, and it was early, it was a very early one, and I was talking about what I'm going to talk about. You know, the cost of the Greenwood Hill programme is on energy. It's 50 to 70 billion per year. And I remember a Guardian journalist and I would say, well, it's a nice idea, £50 billion can't possibly spend that sort of money. Fast forward to today, £50 billion just no penny cash. Why not money? No problem. Banks, multiplied by 10, multiplied by 100. So the idea that it is impossible to find funds for the banks is now gone. The question is, what things are coming from the banks? Okay, so in essence, then, the Green New Deal and which I hope will be introduced in Sheffield, and maybe in Sheffield one will become one of the first places to take it up. In essence, is a kind of massive public and private expenditure program to benefit the environment as well as deal with unemployment and the collapse in economic activity. And so we started with, in a way, the easiest, the low-hanging fruit. And that is energy efficiency and renewables in the buildings in Britain. And our first Green New Deal step, and I suggest it wasn't only the first, and we need further Green New Deals, as I mentioned here. But the first Green New Deal step is saying, okay, what we need to do is to spend, if we spend between 50 to a billion a year on a massive renewable energy production process, lots of offshore wind, rail, etc. But most importantly, and most rapidly, and most easy to do, we started to recognise that we should have a goal for every building and power station. And by that I mean every building is maximum energy efficiency, and where feasible, can also produce some of its own energy. Now, this is not difficult to do. There have been wonderful examples of various efforts all over the world, all over Britain, but they've never been pulled together, and they've always been a kind of orphan idea, an environment. It's back to the serious stuff. And the serious stuff has always been the three B's, which is bricks, boutiques, and banks. That's all any politician, local or national, has thought about as being the way forward. Yeah, let's build some more houses, let's have some more office blocks, let's get some banks and financing people, and let's have a big shopping mall. Yeah, moving to bricks banks. That's always been the priority. So things like energy efficiency, small, noble, bigger, and so on. Now, bricks banks and boutiques are a bust and flush. And so, we're now returning to the idea of how we actually generate huge numbers of jobs. So let's imagine that there was a national decision that we would spend, say, 50 billion, and that would involve training a carbon army of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people crawling over every building in Britain, making energy types and putting on things like solar PV, whatever, photovoltaics, whatever other renewables could help that situation. If you remember when Norse gas came, those urban dwellings had people coming in refitting the gas. We need the same thing, but now to cut back enormously the amount of energy in buildings. So that's 30-40% of the carbon that we put in the atmosphere. So it's a huge saving, most importantly, in today's political reality, of God only anything can generate work and helps to deal with the economic slowdown. That's the political reality. In that new political reality, the potential to do this, the range of jobs we've got, from website designers, engineers, through to draftsmen, it's a huge range of things, involving a vast number of people, huge training incentives, and potential slightly further education. Now, to pay for it, you also make sure that you stop the massive hemorrhage from the tax havens and to various other accounting reasons. This is one of the other things that's occurred in the last year. People are beginning to realise that tax havens and tax avoidance is a crime and must be stopped, and it is beginning to be stopped. So we will be bringing the tax home more. Also, we can have things like carbon taxes, etc., to pay for. But the other important thing to recognise is, and here's some of the economists, but this is really unimaginable, a lot massive, but they say, oh, we've got a problem here. We've got a problem. Okay, you know, the neoliberal model, I agree. We're going to go back to something Roosevelt. I even buy a lot of green deal, you know, spend more money. But of course, the people are paying. And what are they doing? They're saving. You know, Mr. Darling tries to invest throws billions of quid in the factory. Do people run out of the already empty shopping malls? No. A lot of them think, I've got this credit card coming together, I'm losing my job, I've got some. They are saving. Now, the trick that economists don't seem to get is that we have to see these savers as savings. Because the savings have to go somewhere. And one of the most important things to kickstart this every building and power station carbon army training could be local authority bonds. Historically, cities in particular built much of their infrastructure by borrowing money from people, savings and pensions, and building the stuff. So your money went locally. You could see what it was doing. Now, Thatcher, of course, didn't like that because you had too much power to local people. So she centralised stuff, and basically local authorities, as our two next speakers will know, have been beaten down to death by centralised government saying, don't spend this, don't do that, keep to this thing. And by the way, do all these extra other good things that you want to do without giving us money. So they've been browbeaten. But just a few years ago, the government loosened the stays on local authorities and does allow them to raise their own funds. And in London, Transport for London, which is legally a local authority, raised £600 million in three £200 million tranches by issuing a bond. They were scattered. Because if you were a pension fund manager, stock market, I don't think so. Banks, I don't think so. Banks, I don't think so. What? Where can you put your money? So there's a huge hole here that can be filled by savings. And so pension funds are still, even though they've collapsed by a third, they're still around £1,000 billion in pension funds. And they're going up still by about 50. There's been a huge wall of money looking for a safe. So funding isn't a problem. If local authorities, Sheffield, financial sector, etc., decided they would, for example, work out how much it would cost to deal with a dozen housing estates in Sheffield that aren't energy type or could benefit from this system, then you would immediately have a huge potential for jobs. And most of them a show that things can actually happen, things can actually grow. So, how have I got?
One year.
Okay. So, I think the real point I want to make is that things like that, and also, I mean, again, except for Mr. Lord Buckingham, as the post office, could be a fantastic potential for a whole new savings potential, a whole new savings trade. They need to defussify the post offices. What we need to do is, as we've been talking about, it needs to be a trusted bank. But also, the government. self bring guilt, Scott, compensable guilt, then you self bring guilt. If you want to invest in government stock, that is definitely hypothecating the debtor, definitely put into environment change, maybe they give you 0.5% more. It was going to be you. Granny those green bonds, kid those green bonds, families those green bonds, anything that is investing in something which affects the environment is a good, strong case. I'm not talking about funding every wacko thing. It's got to be looked at very carefully, as people say. But the main point to make is you have a wonderful potential mixture of a collapsed economic model, neoliberalism, open market, blah, blah, blah. A response to that, which is the opposite. Let's look to the local. You have a complete and utter political nightmare of unemployment and declining income. The only things politicians are concerned about. Those things suddenly can be answered by the Green New Deal. And that Green New Deal can not only provide a safe and sensible haven for future government expenditure, but it also provides a safe haven for savings. So that's why I am so incredibly optimistic. Because we have, I'm sure, most of you, spent decades bleeding and pleading, please look after the environment, oh please be nice to the world, oh please let's take a few days to the court, people say this. All this kind of stuff, and people say, yeah, let's get back to the batteries, the big teams, the roots. Bam! So, you've got now a real chance for organising around a programme, for example, in Sheffield, that will be seen to answer not just Sheffield's problems, but the nation's problems. And those problems are, how do you generate jobs? How do you generate business opportunities? Where can people put their savings in the first step? So you are really, we're at the edge of a period of tremendous opportunity. The other thing about it is that there's no, I hate using Mrs. Batchelor, but actually, her keynote, there is no alternative, is actually true about this. Because where else are you going to generate the jobs? Where else are you going to deal with climate change? Where else are you going to make a CS dependent on imported energy and carbon steel energy? How else are you going to do it? There isn't any other idea. All their ideas lay in the rubbles of bricks, banks, and continuous. That was all they had to call. And so we do have the really most fantastic potential. Now, the Green New Deal group, as I said, first of all, was really just looking at energy and renewables, because that's the easiest thing. It's very important to get things going, but to give the concept of it. But then, of course, we need to do more to agriculture and the shift from carbon intensive agriculture to more organic agriculture, less processed food, etc., which is more labour intensive, so there is jobs there. We need to look at the whole transport system too. I think the day will come when everybody has a sort of solar PV on their roofs and using the excess of that to maybe charge their car that they use fairly down the public transportation system. I've got to say, in terms of instances that really work, in Germany, alone, they've had a thing called a feed-in tariff for some years. In essence, what that means is if you stick solar photovoltaics on roof, the energy it generates, you don't use yourself, put back in the system, you get paid something like 4 or 5 times you do rent. So it's good money. It's good money. You can actually make a living out of it. The biggest users of photovoltaics in the world are Bavarian farmers. Because they use every single building they've got, basketball, etc., because they're getting money out. And the thing that's great about it, this is why this is so plausible also, is that in Germany now you've got the white boys going around. Oh, I see you're using your roof, Mary. Could I rent a coffee? So many British gas and everything with eight normal streets, people competing with each other to try and cut energy costs with advisors. They cut it by 30% in a very short space of time. If that was done nationally, it would cost half a billion, 10,000 advisors, it would save something like 4.6 billion. It's doable. It's really doable. And so I'll just end by saying that I think Sheffield's in a very, very strong position to take on these kinds of ideas because of its political history, because it has all the problems that every other place has, it has been looking to bricks, banks, and things, and that's fantastic. So it's got to work somewhere else. And the other important thing about it is that the Green New Deal isn't an environmental thing, it's a job generation dealing with the economy thing, which makes it politically pertinent. We move from the whinging fringes into the centre, because we have answers. So it's a fantastic time for all of us, and it can unite trade unionists, business people, with local activists, few positive people, etc. There's a huge potential, not just to bring people together to hear something fabulous on like me, but the potential to bring people together to actually do something. Because as soon as we get something concrete on the ground, for example, in Sheffield, the rest of the country will go like that. And that's the goal. We're turning an economic crisis into a Green New Deal so that we've got some much better future. Thank you very much.